Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, this is the September 2011 edition of the Chemistry World Podcast. I'm Chris Smith, and with me this month are Josh Howjigo, Laura Howes and Eleanor Richards. And we're discussing the link between biofuels and tequila. Yes, trust me, there is one. Why mushrooms benefit from a blast of UV, and also how diamonds could hold the key to the most efficient photovoltaic devices ever made.
So it takes in any form of sunlight, or it could be any form of heat, in fact. The light hits the receiving surface with the diamond coating, and the diamond converts the light into electrons.
And you can hear Neil Fox explaining how his new diamond-based device works very shortly.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And to kick us off, margarita lovers, listen up. Eleanor.
So David King from the Low Carbon Mobility Centre at the University of Oxford and his team have shown that the agave plant can be used as a bioethanol feedstock instead of corn and sugarcane. So the problem with getting bioethanol from corn and sugarcane is that they're obviously food sources too. So there are concerns about land to grow the sources. So the question is, should the land be used for fuel or for food?
So why is agave better than using traditional, what we call traditional sources of bioethanol then?
Agave can grow in arid areas, so the plants don't need water and they don't need intensive fertiliser that the sugarcane and corn need.
OK, so they could potentially bring into use areas of land which at the moment are lying fallow. There's not much to use them for because nothing grows there, so you could plant this stuff on there. What sort of contribution to the biofuel effort could it make?
Well, there's no shortage of desert land, and there are lots of deprived areas located on the edges of deserts. So this could be a method to utilise that unused land and help rejuvenate these deprived areas.
Is it very good as a source of material to turn into bioethanol, this particular plant?
Yes, but there are a few problems to iron out before it can be used as a feedstock. They are slow-growing crops, and until now they've been harvested manually. So you have a labour issue and a yield issue. But the researchers do say that they can work on increasing the yield and automating the harvesting.
Which would be nice. And there's one very important thing you haven't touched on yet, which is that apart from being feedstock for bioethanol, tequila is an important human feedstock for various things, including margarita. So that's also made from the same plant. So is there likely to be an impact on this? Hope not.
Well, the researchers do assure us that actually the tequila supply will be fine.
Well, that's a big reassurance, but I'm surprised they even bothered to mention it, but there we are. I thought I'd catch you with that one. Now, Laura, moving over to you, we've discussed this sort of concept before on the Chemistry World podcast, which is the whole question of where life came from and how life got started. And there's this whole idea of the RNA world hypothesis, actually where the nucleic acids just popped up to start with and then began to become self-replicating and ultimately became cells and so on. But one of the big outstanding questions is why they have a particular handedness, this chirality question, molecules coming right and left-handed flavours, and why life almost universally uses left-handed amino acids to make proteins and right-handed sugars in things like its DNA.
That's right, Chris. However much you might want to support the RNA world hypothesis and show that you can take these simple precursors and make the beginnings of RNA, up until now, people have only been able to make what we call racemic mixtures, so an equal mix of these left and right-handed molecules. And that's not what we have in our own bodies. That's not what life is today.
Indeed. So what do they think could have accounted for the fact we have this stark contrast? This particular type of molecule is exclusively used in life versus the other isomer isn't?
No one will ever really know. We're not going to be able to go back in a time machine. But people are trying to play with this idea. And Donna Blackman at Scripps in the US was noticing that if you have one particular handedness molecule, that can often direct how a reaction will go. But that doesn't help matters because if you've got 100% a right-handed molecule, that just sends the question back a bit. How did you get 100% of this right-handed or left-handed molecule?
Indeed, so what is she saying could have tripped life or whatever to adopt one particular handedness or favour it over another?
what she's actually shown is that you actually only need a very, very slight mismatch. So you could have, say, 49% of one handedness, 51% of another, and that will be enough to knock everything. And then once it's going, it's gone, and it all spirals, well, but it all amplifies from that.
So what experiment did she do to prove that then?
Well, there's a quite simple experiment, quite simple reaction that people have done to create some RNA precursors, just using a three-component reaction, using glyceraldehyde and 2-aminooxazole, and then one of the, well, you can use any amino acid, that tends to be what you use to direct the chirality. Donna had seen that if you use proline, that's a very good one for directing how the reaction will go. And she proved this with 100% one-handedness of proline, and funnily enough, it all went in one direction. And then she mixed them up together, a racemic mix, so a left-handed, right-handed mix of one, a left-handed, right-handed mix of another, and then with the proline, just a very, very slight imbalance. And still, it managed to go all the way to being the D-ribonucleic acid, which is the one that we have today.
Does she give any suggestions as to why? Because one suggestion is that life adopted a particular bias because there was a predominance of that particular form of molecule handedness back in the early vestiges of the Earth.
Yep.
And one suggestion is that the reason there was that predominance is because things like meteorites and comets raining in from outer space just by chance happen to have a bias towards one particular isomer.
Sure, and we don't know what it is that if the RNA world hypothesis indeed is the one that actually worked, and that's one possibility. The other possibility is just that when you're doing a reaction, you will get these little imbalances. It's like flipping a coin. You might get 10 heads in a row one time, and that could have just been it.
Just like that, as Tommy Cooper would say. Thank you, Laura. A major priority worldwide is to make much better use of the terajoules of energy that hit the Earth in the form of sunlight every day. Bristol scientist Neil Fox is working on a way to do that with diamonds by producing a thermionic energy converter that can capture light energy, including infrared, and pump out power.
The aim of the project is to produce a demonstration of a technology called a thermionic energy converter to develop a new material, a nanostructured material based on diamond. But the attraction of diamond is that it's incredibly resistant to corrosion. It can be cycled many times, and in a solar application where there are constant heating up and cooling down cycles occurring each time the sun goes in and out, this is particularly important. But we are interested in the surface of diamond, because it's at the surface of these diamond materials that we have energy conversion taking place.
Well, James Bond famously used diamonds in Diamonds Are Forever, or at least the bad guys did. They wanted to make a laser. But you're talking about actually using the diamonds to capture solar energy.
That's right. It's not really a solar cell per se. It's a solar energy converter. So it takes in heat or thermal energy. That could be any form of sunlight, or it could be any form of heat, in fact. But if we concentrate on solar, then it's a broadband absorber, effectively, which means that all the light hits the receiving surface with the diamond coating, and the diamond converts the light into electrons, and they are given off, pass across the device, and on the other side of the device, they are captured, give up a lot of heat, but they also carry potential energy in addition to that kinetic energy, which is the heat. And that potential energy is then used to generate a voltage across the device. And because we've already moved those carriers across from one side to the other, from the hot side to the cold side, that means that we're able to generate an electrical power output from this device.
So can we look for a second at actually what is happening at the surface when the photons, the light particles, come in and impact on the diamond surface? Mm-hmm. How are they doing the energy transfer? What's actually happening chemically in the diamond to do that?
It's an electro-optic effect, really. The heat promoting carriers to a high level where they can be moved out of the material into a vacuum. That's essentially how a thermionic emission works. You're giving carriers in the material kinetic and potential energy, and that lifts them over an energy barrier and allows them to escape and move away from the surface.
So why does diamond have lots of carriers that are available to be knocked out like this and made available?
Diamond, although it's deemed to be an insulator, is essentially a semiconductor with a very wide band gap. And it's possible to introduce impurities into this synthetic material that we use to make it easier to promote electron carriers into what's called a conduction band. And in this case, the carriers are being moved towards the surface. And once at the surface, what they see in diamond is a launch pad, because the diamond surface has been functionalized. So we've put chemicals on the surface to change the effective ease with which you can get them off the surface. In other words, we've changed the work function of the surface. And the way we've done that is to functionalize this surface with lithium and oxygen. And what that does is it's easier for those carriers to escape out into vacuum.
So that coating grabs the carriers as they're generated by the diamond, and you can then tap them off.
That's right. They're pulled out of the surface, if you like.
So if you get this working, how much energy will you get?
Well, typically in the UK, you're looking at, during the summertime, certainly about 2.5 kilowatts per square metre. And we would be looking to convert about 25% of that into electrical power, if not more. And that's quite high compared to typical silicon solar cells. They're about 16 to 18%. The reason why thermionics are so much higher is because it can operate by using a much broader range of the spectrum. So from that point of view, conversion rates ought to be higher. Also, this device for the application for utility scale, we've got to pitch to quite a high level, because the utility concentrated solar installations that they have in places like southern Spain, typically the system efficiencies there are about 22%. So for thermionic energy converters to work at a utility scale, we've really got to get up to efficiencies which exceed that, so that they do have some benefit for that type of installation. But the other application we're particularly interested in is microgeneration, being able to put this technology onto housing, onto factories, supermarkets, alongside conventional solar panels. And the benefit there is that power density is a lot higher, because we use concentration to concentrate the radiation onto these devices. And it also produces waste heat in the form of hot water. So it's very much a solar thermal technology, but with the added benefit of producing both electricity and wastewater.
Neil Fox, and he reckons conservatively that they're just 3 years away from a commercial product hitting the market. Aren't diamonds wonderful things? Now, Josh, apparently there's every reason to turn the other cheek with a new skin repair material.
Yeah, so basically there's a bit of a problem where if you have damage to soft tissue, so the sort of thing that's in your cheeks, that kind of thing, sometimes it can be quite difficult for that to be repaired, because basically we need some kind of support to help the tissue grow back. And there's kind of two approaches you can use. You can use like a synthetic artificial material, but often there's problems with that kind of thing because it can kind of be rejected by the body, and it can cause severe inflammation and those kind of undesirable side effects. Or the other option would be having a graft of soft tissue from somewhere else, but that's got the issue of, well, one, you've got to find somewhere to take it from, which might not be that fun, and also the fact that that can be degraded very quickly sometimes by the body as well. So neither of those two things are perfect solutions.
So what have you got to offer instead?
So what we have instead is a piece of work which has been carried out by Jennifer Ellis-Eaf from Johns Hopkins University in the US. And what she's done is basically created a pretty simple system. It's based on polyethylene glycol, which is a polymer which is known to be biocompatible, so it doesn't get rejected by the body. And she's used this, which has got some methacrylate side chains on it, and she's added in another biocompatible kind of cross linker, plus a photoinitiator molecule. And what she can do is inject a mixture of those components into a region which has been damaged, so for example in a face or something. That mixture can then be massaged to give the correct sort of structure, and then you can irradiate it with an ultraviolet light, and then the cross-linking will occur. And
it polymerizes and fixes.
Exactly, yeah, cross-links.
How neat. So you can actually put the skin or the tissue into the configuration you want and then almost fix it with the UV light. Does the UV get far enough in to do a good job of that?
They've had to modify it a little bit, I think, because, yeah, you do have obviously some problems with penetration with UV sometimes. And actually, I was a bit worried that you'd get, like, you know, sunburn or something. But they've tested it on rats and apparently there's no problems.
I guess it will also depend on the wavelength of the UV, because
yes,
longer wavelength UV is probably a bit safer, but that will depend on what the molecules are and where they absorb the energy.
That's right. The
problem I can see with this, though, is how do you get the polyethylene glycol scaffold back out again once it's done the job and help the tissue to fix?
Well, yeah, that obviously we want to be able to do that. How the guys do it is they inject some enzymes which are able to digest the carbon-oxygen bonds, and then it will just degrade, and obviously it creates biocompatible products, I guess.
And when it is in there, what's its role? How is it helping tissue to get better?
Well, it's not really doing anything on a kind of biological level. It's basically just acting as a scaffold so that filaments and tissue can just basically use it as a scaffold to grow on, basically.
So it guides cells back into where they need to go to make a wound heal?
Yeah, it does.
And just in rats? Or have they actually got some clinical data from people now?
We spoke to the researchers and they said that at the moment it's only in rats, but they're working to do some human trials at the moment.
Thanks, Josh. Well, let's stick with the skin. And Eleanor, you're going under the skin in a different way, and this is a way of powering up nanorobots.
Oh yes, science fiction comes to life. So there's a team from the National Chiao Tung University in Taiwan, led by Fang Chung Chen. What they've done is they've made a small power device that can be inserted underneath your skin, and these can control nanorobots that are placed in your body for medical purposes.
Gosh, so how does this work, this thing that you implant? It makes electricity?
It does, yeah. It takes energy from infrared light, so it converts the light energy within it to an electrical output that can control the nanorobots.
What would you view the nanorobots as doing? How do they say this could be used?
Well, the researchers suggest that they could be used to inhibit pain or control a disease, for example.
Okay, so that's a bit more futuristic. So focusing on the here and now with the with the actual power patch.
Yeah.
Chemically speaking, how does it actually work?
Well, it's a two-layer organic photovoltaic cell. The layers are sandwiched between conducting layers. And of these two layers, one layer is an electron donor and the other one's an electron acceptor. And when a light photon is absorbed by the acceptor, and that comes from the infrared light that's been shown on the device, this creates an electron hole pair on the interface between the donor and the acceptor. And then the pair dissociates at the interface, and this creates the current.
And how much energy can this thing make? What's the energy density?
Well, when the team measured the electrical output, it came to 0.32 microwatts. And they say that that's more than enough to drive many biological nanodevices at the same time.
So what's the energy demand of a nanorobot then?
So the typical power needed for one nanodevice is approximately 10 nanowatts.
So it should be more than enough.
It should
be. A whole
be.
Army of nanorobots.
Should be, yes.
Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Eleanor. You're listening to the Chemistry World podcast in September 2011 with me, Chris Smith. And still to come, the nano sponge that you can wring out magnetically. First, though, to cancer and how scientists have come round to the idea that lurking inside a tumour are some cells that are far more malignant than others because they behave as stem cells capable of reseeding a tumour even after surgery or chemotherapy has wiped out the bulk of the disease.
My name is Alan Clark, and I'm a professor of cancer biology at Cardiff University. And one of the things that my laboratory works on is understanding the link between those cells, which are stem cells in your normal body, which do things like repair your normal tissues, and the link that those cells might have with tumours, which are often considered to be unregulated growth of stem cell equivalents, which drive tumour development.
So the bottom line is that where we've gone from a perspective of a cancer was a big growth of cells, they're all a mixture, a mixed bag of cells, but if we chop that tumour out, all will be well. We're now of a mindset that underlying that could well be cells that have the ability to regenerate or rekindle that tumour if we leave any of them behind.
It's what we've known for a long time is that cancers are heterogeneous, and that means that not all of the cells are equivalent within the cancer. And for some time we've known that there's been a population, subpopulation of cells, which are particularly good at reforming the tumour if you separate the cells out and ask them what their capacity is to rebuild the tumour. And some seem to be much better at doing that than the rest of the tumour. And so, as you say, this has given a rise to the notion that there are a population of driving cells within a tumour, and it's actually a small population of cells which caused the tumour to originally grow, and then when you treat it with conventional therapy, when the tumour can relapse and regrow again, it's those cells that actually drive that.
What about when we look at treatment for cancers, though? Because many treatments focus on tumour bulk reduction. You give a chemotherapy agent and it destroys millions of cells. But are these stem cells equivalently vulnerable or not?
This is, again, where it becomes potentially very exciting, is that perhaps we've been looking at tumour therapy in the wrong way. Traditionally, we look at therapy as being successful if it debulks, if it reduces the size of the tumour. If you kill cells within a tumour, the end result normally is that the tumour gets smaller. However, if what you're doing is killing the cells which aren't the drivers within the tumour, you're actually killing the non-driving cells, and the tumour apparently responds, but in fact the cells which are the driving cells are left intact within the tumour, and the tumour can fully grow back again. What you've done is fail in your therapeutic approach. In fact, what you might need to do is go in and look for therapies which specifically target the driving cells.
How can we spot those needles in the haystack? Because these stem cells are presumably there only at much lower frequency compared with the vast bulk of the tumour.
It is this concept and notion that actually those driving cells within the tumour share a lot of properties with normal stem cells, and that's why they've been called a cancer stem cell. And we think that actually by looking at the normal properties of normal stem cells in normal tissues, we're going to get clues which will allow us to identify the cancer stem cell, so-called, that sits within the tumour and acts as the driving population. And it will be a comparison and a contrast and a comparison between those two populations, the normal stem cells and the cells which might drive the tumour, which we think will allow us to find that needle in the haystack and go in and therapeutically kill the driving cell within the cancer.
Well, it seems to be a day for clichés. From needles in haystacks to chickens and eggs, do those stem cells come first and turn into tumour cells, or can some of the tumour cells actually go back and turn back into stem cells?
Yeah, so this, and again, this is one of these terribly important questions that needs to be answered now, is where I think we're most interested at the moment is in this transit from the normal stem cell to a potential cancer stem cell as a driver within the tumour, and we think we've got fairly good evidence that that process happens with a reasonable efficiency. And so it's understanding the switches that turn a normal stem cell into one that can drive the tumour, which I think is perhaps an area which is going to be very fruitful.
Now, one of the big problems with treating cancer that we've seen all along is how to get the treatment selective. So they pick on just the cancer and they leave the healthy tissue, and it's when that doesn't happen that you get terrible side effects.
Yeah.
If we're going to end up with therapies that target stem cells, are we going to see even more of a problem trying to make it selective for the cancer stem cell?
Well, again, yes. And again, it's down to understanding the differences and the switches that turn a normal stem cell into a cancer stem cell, which allow us to generate therapeutics which specifically target the cancer stem cell and not the normal stem cell. We do have something going for us in that we know that there is large plasticity and great capacity for repair within the normal tissue, so that even if you do delete the normal stem cell, you can repair that, what we call a niche, is where the stem cell will reside, and there is sufficient plasticity within the system that you can rebuild the stem cell population. So you can produce therapies which actually, and we do this in an experimental setting, where you actually wipe out all of the stem cells, all of the normal stem cells, and indeed all of the cancer stem cells, but there's still sufficient plasticity within the normal tissue that you can rebuild the normal stem cell population.
And if I could hand you a very large check from one of these research councils that used to have lots of money to give away and now has less. What would you spend it on in this field? Where do we need to direct our funding in the next 5 years?
I think we're talking about cliches, but the lowest hanging fruit, which is a really horrible cliche, may be to actually go back and look at conventional therapies that we have and combinations of conventional therapies that we know don't work brilliantly, but perhaps go back and look at novel combinations and novel mixtures of agents and test them against cancer stem cell populations so that we can avoid having to develop brand new drugs, which is extremely expensive, but actually go back and ask the question, do we have reagents currently on the shelf that in combination may actually target the cancer stem cell population very, very efficiently?
Alan Clark from Cardiff University. And in fact, in a paper in Science Translational Medicine last month, Dutch researchers have effectively done what Alan is suggesting, which is to write a computer program that can marry up the changes induced in gene expression in tissues affected by a disease with drugs that produce the mirror image opposite changes in the same genes. The result is a host of new treatments for old diseases, but based on existing drugs. And now, Josh, I'm intrigued by the notion of a nano sponge. So is this a microscopic equivalent of the kind of thing you would find on the seabed?
No, it's not. It's a bit like an undersea sponge in that it can hold, you know, something. So not liquid necessarily, but it can hold something and then it can squeeze itself out. But the point here is that instead of wringing it out with hands, the idea is that you can apply a magnetic field and then particles will align themselves and then whatever's in the pores of the sponge will be expelled into the environment.
Be wrung out. So how small is this? Is this something which we're talking nanoscale or is this potentially macroscale sponge?
We are talking very much nanoscale. The paper has a picture of one of these sponges, which is about 200 nanometers in diameter.
Oh, tiny. So the idea would be that when you have a cargo in there, it will be just dispensing tiny amounts of whatever is in the cavities in the sponge.
Yeah. So what it is, it's by the work is carried out by a guy called Toshiaki Enoki, who's from the Tokyo Institute of Technology. And what he's done is he's taken palladium and cobalt magnetic nanoparticles, and then he's taken long alkyl chains, about 20 carbons or 30 carbons long, which have thiol, so that's SH groups on the end of each, on each end of the chain. And then he's kind of created like a matrix where each nanoparticle magnetic ball is kind of linked to other ones by these stretchy alkyl chains.
So how do you wring it out then?
Well, so if in just under ambient conditions, all the kind of nanospheres, I guess, are kind of in a kind of random orientation. As soon as you apply a magnetic field, they align themselves in line with that. And so that reduces the kind of area in between the spheres. They close up and whatever is in the matrix is expelled, basically.
Which sounds very useful. Is it practical? Can you make this easily? Does it work under the sorts of conditions where we would want to use it?
Yeah, I mean, it does sound really good. I mean, for example, like something like drug delivery, you'd imagine that if if it was possible to take this sponge, load it with a drug, give it to the body, and then apply a magnetic field in the place that you want the drug to be released, that sounds really attractive.
Like but cancer, for example, if you could get this to associate with cancer cells or tumours, then just you put a localised magnetic field through the tumour and you discharge the contents discreetly and directly into the tumour.
Absolutely. I mean, that would sort of be the holy grail of what we're looking for with, chemotherapy.
I sense an if or a but coming, though.
Yeah, there's a huge if. Unfortunately, they have to use a magnetic field of 7 Tesla, which is frankly ridiculous.
Monumentally big. I think an MRI scanner runs at about 3. So that's a big field. I think that would be levitatingly large. What about temperature? Because many of these things also have a very discrete temperature range as well.
Yeah, they also have to cool it down very close to absolute zero to get this to work.
Okay, so totally impractical.
It's completely impractical, and I think the authors would agree with that. We spoke to them, and they said that, yeah, I mean, this is a prototype. So it's very much a proof of concept, this work. We're not going to cure cancer with this magnetic sponge tomorrow, unfortunately.
But it's a starting point, and one would guess that having proved that you can do this, now it's a question of looking for the right materials that will make it feasible at the kinds of temperatures and magnetic fields that are a bit more achievable.
Yeah, I think so.
Now, Laura, let's go from magnetic sponges that you need very, very low temperatures to work on to something that actually sounds pretty practical for a room temperature and general scale sort of application? This is cyclodextrins becoming enzymes.
So cyclodextrins are these sort of large sugar molecules, many sugars that end up making sort of a donut shape. So, you know, they go around and there's a sort of a cavity inside. And people have used them as catalysts before. People have used them for various things, but they haven't really got them working for polymerization before. And that's what Akira Harada at Osaka University has been doing.
When you say they use them as a sort of a catalyst or something, is that because you've got the correct configuration or arrangement of molecules in the right sort of places so that they will participate in certain reactions and make them happen more efficiently? Like, just like an enzyme made of protein does.
Precisely, that you would have sort of an active site where these molecules will fit into in an enzyme. Cyclodextrin is really well known for what we call host-guest interactions. It really likes having other small molecules come and sit inside it, and once you've got them sitting together nice and closely, then often interesting chemistry can happen.
So how have they done this? What's the next step then? So how have they managed to go from just making this interesting host-guest chemistry happen to actually making it into something that can stitch molecules into long chains?
When they were starting to look at using cyclodextrins for polymerisation reactions, and by polymerisation reactions, we're literally talking about making polyesters, so plastics, they were realising that if they just had free cyclodextrins, actually, they were kind of pairing up. And one cyclodextrin molecule was actually doing the reaction. It was being the host and the guest. And the other one was kind of helping chaperone the growing polymer and helping pull it slowly, control it and keep it where it was. And so it wasn't a huge leap to think, well, instead of having just cyclodextrins floating around, we'll pair these up and we'll make dimers of cyclodextrin. So one cyclodextrin sits here doing the catalytic reaction. Meanwhile, the other cyclodextrin sits a little bit further away, and the growing polymer chain threads through the cyclodextrin, and it manages to hold it there, keeps it steady, keeps it in the right place, and it also helps pull the growing chain away. So instead of the chain getting all gunked up, it sort of slowly manages to pull it away, so as it grows, it sort of keeps perpetuating.
It's almost like knitting.
It is almost like knitting. It's a really clever bit of chemistry.
With no drop stitches.
No drop stitches, none at all. So it's just slowly sort of helping it grow, which is something to do with what we call the pseudo-rotaxane effect. We often see that if you have cyclodextrins and their molecules, they'll sort of thread through the cyclodextrin. So it's a known phenomenon, but the way that we've got them paired together is quite nice, and it means that instead of doing polymerization reactions with metal catalysts and horrible organic solvents, they're able to do them without any of these. So it's a much sort of greener, more friendly process.
Brilliant. Well, while you're in the hot seat, you can catalyse another thing for us, which is this week's trivia. What have you got for us?
Oh, so today I want to know, see whether you can answer this. Why do you think I might want to give my mushrooms a go on the tanning bed?
Give your mushrooms a go.
Yes. Why would I put my mushrooms on a tanning bed?
Something to do with melanin, the dark pigment?
Well, it's a little bit like that. It's not melanin, though. It's actually something else that we make when we go out in the sunlight.
Vitamin D?
It is vitamin D, precisely. So, interestingly, when we go out in the sun, we take cholesterol and sterols, and we make vitamin D in the skin. It turns out that mushrooms do the same thing.
What on earth do mushrooms do with vitamin D? We use it to make strong bones. Wonder what they do with it.
I have absolutely no idea, but it's the same. It's the same enzymes, pretty much the same family of enzymes are there.
So they make the precursor of vitamin D.
Yeah.
So then, if I were to eat those, would I get a super dose of vitamin D precursor?
Yeah. So you would be able to have a bioavailable, enriched foodstuff that's full of vitamin D.
So you have to grow the mushrooms under UV?
No, you grow the mushrooms normally. You take them and then you can just sit them under a UV lamp.
For how long?
A couple of hours. It's really not long.
Gosh, quick.
It really is. You could also put them out in sunlight, but what they've actually found is that if you put them out in sunlight, it degrades some of the other vitamins and minerals.
Well, so someone come along and nick them.
Well, someone might do that as well. But if you put it out in sunlight, then you'd it actually degrades some of the other things. But if you give it a precise dose of UVB specifically, then it ends up fortifying it with vitamin D and not really reducing any of the other vitamins, minerals and good things that are in there.
Laura Howes, she's a fun gal. Sorry. That's it for this month. Thank you also to contributors Eleanor Richards and Josh Hadjigo, and our interview guests Neil Fox and Alan Clark. Production this month was by Meera Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientists.com. Join us for more cutting-edge chemistry next month, but until then, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.